Hi, this is Ken McCarthy, and this is Jazz on the Tube. And today we're talking with somebody who I've had in mind to interview for a long time. And by amazing coincidence, he sent me a note the very moment I was reading his name on the web. So I saw that as a sign that it was time to do it and finally get Bobby Sanabria on the phone. Welcome, Bobby.
Hi, Ken. Pleasure to be here.
Really great to have you. And I know a lot of people already know Bobby and his work. But we're going to get into it in more detail. But before we even get into the interview, I want to talk about a project that's coming up very soon. And everybody take out your calendars and mark this date.
Which is coming up pretty soon, Friday, February 24th, at the Manhattan School of Music, where I'm a faculty member. We're recreating West Side Story with the Afro-Cuban Jazz Orchestra that I teach there, but we're reimagining it, re-envisioning it, from the Latin jazz perspective. So the Bernstein music will be reinterpreted with rhythms from the Latin jazz canon. So you'll hear things like Officer Crumpy done with the rhythms of Puerto Rico, bomba and plena. You'll hear Somewhere done as a joropo, Venezuelan joropo. And I don't want to give too much out, but because I want everybody to obviously come and be curious to this event, but this orchestra that I teach at the Manhattan School of Music, I've gotten them to the point where they're so good that they've been nominated for Grammys with some of the recordings that we've done, and rivaling my own big band that's been nominated for recordings. And I always tell my musicians, I always crack them up in rehearsals, because if they start making mistakes, where they go, listen, man, I'll get my students to come in here to play this, you know? So. But it's a fabulous reimagining of this. I've always been a fan of Bernstein. He's one of my favorite composers, along with people like Duke Ellington and Don Ellis and Maestro Tito Puente. And you know, so this music that we're doing of West Side Story is incredible, as many of you have that are listening to this have seen the movie and or the Broadway show. And we're celebrating the 60th anniversary of West Side Story. 1957, September 1957, it premiered at the Winter Garden Theater in New York City. And the audience was flabbergasted because nobody had ever heard anything like West Side Story or seen anything like West Side Story on every level, you know, from the dialogue to the choreography to the book to obviously the music, which, in my opinion, the music for West Side Story is probably the hardest music that's ever been written for Broadway, simply because of the opening whistle that you hear that everybody knows, that is what we call in music a tritone, which is the interval of modern jazz harmony. So that opens up the wondrous world of West Side Story. And it's very relevant today because of all of the controversies that people are having, talking amongst themselves, et cetera, and this country is going through with immigration. And as everybody knows, the story of West Side Story is about two young lovers. One is a Puerto Rican, Maria, the other one, American, you know, of Polish, and I believe he's Italian descent or Irish descent, Tony, and they fall in love. And the story gets even more complicated because Puerto Ricans are not immigrants, they're migrants. We are migrants because we are American citizens. We've been American citizens since 1917 when the Jones Act was passed in Congress. So that adds another level of complexity to it. But it's based off of Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet. And the backstory of West Side Story, of the production of West Side Story, is even more amazing. But we needed a couple more hours to talk about that.
Right.
But we hope everybody comes to this fabulous concert. It'll be recorded also.
I was just about to ask. But those of you that are listening that are in New York or that can get to New York, it's February 24th. And even though it's going to be recorded, see it live. Because this is really, I'm excited about this. This is really interesting. How long have you been working on this? This must be a very involved project.
Yeah, for the last couple of months, yeah. So the Bernstein family, the Bernstein estate fully embraced it. And the Bernstein family is going to be there. Some of the members of the family are going to be there. And we're hoping Stephen Sondheim comes as well. I think he's going to be there because he's said already that he wants to come and see it and hear it. So, but for those of you who are fans of the music, this is coming from a completely jazz and Latin perspective, so there's not going to be any singing at all. So don't expect to see a chorus of singers on stage or any dancing or anything like that. It's coming strictly from the perspective of jazz and Latin musicians reinterpreting this music using rhythms from the Latin jazz kind. And Manhattan School of Music is very easy to get to. It's West 122nd Street and Broadway. It's at 7:30. We have a restaurant in the school, so I would get there early because the tickets are free. First come, first serve. So
amazing.
And this is in June I'll be 60 years old. So West Side Story celebrates 60. I celebrate 60 coming up in a few months. So I figured this is a great way to celebrate this year. And as you know, this year is a very important year in jazz. It's the 100th birthday of Ella Fitzgerald, Buddy Rich, Dizzy Gillespie. I believe it's the 100th birthday, of Thelonious Monk as well. So there's a lot of things happening this year. There's a good synergy happening in terms of the jazz world this year. And God knows we need it now, especially with what's happening in Washington, D.C. So, but that's another topic of discussion.
It is, and it's, you know, one of the ways to fight is with art.
Exactly.
That's what makes this, I think, such an important venture. And, you know, it's also the 100th, I believe, it's the 100th anniversary of the first ever jazz recording.
Oh, it is. That's all right. I failed to mention it. Right. I was just in New Orleans for the Jazz Education Network conference, and that was the whole theme of the conference, the 100th anniversary of the first recording.
Actually, we were down there too. That was quite I had never been to one of those before. What an amazing 3 or 4 days that was.
Oh, yeah. The Jens, everybody should support it, especially if you're a musician listening to this. It's very easy to join. I believe it's only like $50 or $60 to join. And I think as a new member, you're able to download 4 free big band arrangements as well. But it's really a nice thing because when I was coming up as a musician, the community of jazz was exactly that, a community. And we've kind of lost that now in this modern day and age. And we need to get back to that. So the Jazz Education Network Conference and the organization reminds us of that we're a community. And this is America's greatest art form. And it really saddens me that most of mainstream America has kind of abandoned the music, forgotten the music, et cetera. There's a lot of reasons for that we could get into, but the main thing is we got to remedy that situation because, as Louis Armstrong said, without jazz, there's no rock and roll. And of course, that means there's no anything else, not even Latin jazz. So it's a great organization, and I wholeheartedly support it.
I got a kick out of seeing so many young people with music, with instrument cases. I mean, for people that weren't there, you just have to imagine a huge hotel. And everywhere you go, there's clumps of kids walking back and forth with trombone and trumpet cases and sax cases. And it's, you really feel like you feel like jazz is alive at this conference, that it has legs. There's the new generation's definitely interested. We can't say they're not interested. We may not be giving them all the opportunities we should be giving them, but clearly they're interested. And they're talented too.
Some of these kids are amazing. Literally amazing teenage kids that play so well and great improvisers, and some of the high school and college big bands that I saw were really super sounding great, very, very professional, and that's a testimony to their band directors as well.
It's a really dedicated group of people out there. There's a lot of people that are doing beautiful work educating the young in jazz, running these bands, giving them opportunities to play. And I you know, we're roughly the same age. I'm just 2 years from 60, but yeah, there used to be working opportunities for young musicians and that big bands. And that doesn't exist anywhere near as much as it used to. So it's great that the schools are filling in the gaps. I don't remember, maybe you do. I mean, it's funny. I went to high school in New York City and I lived in the North Bronx, and I don't remember there being high school jazz bands of any great quality in those days, but maybe I just
missed it. They were there. Probably the most prominent one was the one at the school. The school is now called the LaGuardia High School for the Performing Arts, but back when we were young, it was called Music and Art High School. and they had a great big band, and people like Kenny Washington and Ray Vega, and I believe, Marcus Miller, bass player, and quite a few musicians that have made an impact over the years came from that program, and that was run by Justin DeChocho, who eventually would become the head of the jazz department at Manhattan School of Music. And we're kind of sad because he just retired, you know, from the Manhattan School of Music. So
okay.
Our new incoming director of jazz at the school will be Stefan Harris, and he'll be coming in July, the great vibes player, who is an alumnus of the Manhattan School of Music. But the one thing that I do remember that when I was younger was that we had great music programs all throughout the public school system in New York City. And then what happened was, and then, you know, it was a requirement that you had to take music in public school. Like in the fifth grade, the homeroom teacher would come in, say, who would like to learn to play a musical instrument? Write three choices on this index card. Well, if you did that today, the students wouldn't even know what to put down because they don't even know what a trumpet, a trombone, or a saxophone is. But in any case, back then, they would ask you, write down three choices, and then, okay, who doesn't want to learn a musical instrument? You raise your hand. He goes, okay, you people are in the choir, you know, you're in the chorus.
Wow.
In chorus, you would learn how to sing harmony, et cetera. And that's why that's one of the reasons that I believe that we had great doo-wop groups and R&B groups coming out of New York City, because people know how to sing harmony. And of course, when you were a kid, you looked up to musicians. They were your heroes. Today, kids just want to be celebrities. But back then, we wanted to be baseball players, et cetera, athletes, or musicians. So it was a different time period, obviously. But what happened was, as you well know, being a New Yorker, the city went bankrupt in the late 60s. And the first thing they did was cut all the arts programs. And oddly enough, because of that, hip-hop culture started in the South Bronx, because kids couldn't make music with instruments anymore. Like you said, it was seeing kids walking around with instruments in New Orleans at that convention. It was very common in New York City to see kids back then walking around with clarinet cases, saxophone cases, trombone cases, etc. And you don't see that anymore, obviously. And that was because the city cut all the music programs. And parenthetically from that came kids in the South Bronx experimenting with turntables, etc., making music that way.
Wow.
And if you talk to the early pioneers of hip-hop, like the DJs, rappers like Rakim, Grandmaster Caz, Grandmaster Flash, Jazzy J, and all these people, they talk about jazz. They talk about, I wanted to learn an instrument. I wanted to play jazz. My parents were into jazz. But they cut the music programs in my school. So we didn't have music anymore. So I started making music the only way I knew how, using my parents' records and manipulating those on turntables. So there is a connection. I know a lot of my brethren in jazz community put down rap, hip hop, but I just look at it as part of the continuum of the jazz tradition. And really good DJs, they improvise. You should see them. They improvise just like jazz musicians, or act like instantaneous arrangers, musical arrangers, but using the technology of today. So there's something to be said for that. And we need to not put them down. We need to embrace them. But also we need to get music back into the public school system. And in the way I think, we should also make jazz part of the history. It should be a requirement to be part of the curriculum of American history in every public school in the United States. Once you get to the fifth grade and you learn about the Louisiana Purchase and all that kind of stuff, well, what came out of that in New Orleans? This incredible art form, America's greatest art form, which is jazz. Every kid should know that.
And we see when they're exposed to the music, especially when they're younger, they like it. I'll tell you a funny story. I was playing some Machito, and my nephew was over when he was maybe 3 years old, somewhere very young, very young. He'd never heard it before. He stopped in his tracks, and he immediately started dancing around. And he yelled out, it's a jazz party, Uncle Ken.
Right.
I didn't teach him. I didn't sit him down and say, okay, this is Machito. This is really good. You should enjoy this. No one had to tell him that it was good music, you know? So that's why I said earlier on, you know, we're kind of letting the younger generation down, and hopefully we're going to turn that around. I think the internet's helping a little bit. It's letting kids, we actually have a fair number of kids that take advantage of Jazz on the Tube and watch the videos, and they get to see Monk play or Sonny Rollins or John Coltrane, and they realize, wow, these are real people making this music, and it puts the seed in their head that jazz is cool.
Right. Well, I always say, I mean, use the internet to your advantage. I mean, sometimes I'm talking about really young people, teenagers, and even younger, tell me, Mr. Sanabria, why are you so harping on, you know, you got to know about jazz? And I said, because you don't know what you're missing out on. And plus, it's your birthright as an American citizen. This is your music. This is our culture. You know, I mean, hip-hop, which you like to listen to today, rap particularly, because there is a difference between hip-hop and rap. But that being said, you know, I tell the kids, what you like comes from this. And
right.
I saw a video of Cab Calloway rapping, and they start scratching their heads. What? You know, like, or I go, you like drums? And they go, yeah. You know, so, because you guys are always talking about the beat, you know, spitting rhymes over a beat. Well, check this out. And I'll show them some Buddy Rich. And that's what really floors them. When they see somebody like Buddy Rich wailing on drums, they go, oh my, you know, they go, oh my God. They're like mesmerized. They can't believe it. So Wynn has talked about this and others, you know, just expose them to the music, expose them. The great art will do the rest. And the great thing about jazz is it's the only art form that I know of that encompasses every other art form but still retains its identity, which is what is jazz's main identity, that the musicians are storytellers as virtuosic improvisers using. But now somebody would tell me, well, you know, every culture improvises. You know, you got in European music and folk music traditions, musicians always improvise. I go, yeah, but the way we improvise is completely different, because jazz has to have some element of always of the blues in it, which gives us the African-American identity to jazz, the way we improvise, which utilizing not only harmony from the blues, but blues inflection, all the things that make up the black experience in this country. So it's a wonderful thing, and you know, you're passionate about it. I'm so glad that what you guys do at Jazz on the Tube. I use it frequently assigning homework to my students at the Music and at the New School. I say, hey, this is your homework this week. Look at this.
That's so great. I hear that more and more, and it's something I didn't even think of when I started it. And then I realized, wow, this is a pretty good reference library for someone teaching jazz, you know.
Right.
Hey, we're going to play some Monk. Go look at Monk play. You know, you don't have to. And this is kind of a big thing, because, you know, we're celebrating the 100th year of recorded music, and having recordings possible changed the destiny of music in a way, because, you know, when you had a Charlie Parker in the old days, if you weren't in the room when he played, all you would ever hear were the stories about him. You would never know what he actually did, you know, but we can actually hear what Charlie Parker did. And now, thanks to some of these videos, we can actually see. And people may say, well, you know, music's an auditory art. Why do you need to see it? And I don't really know the answer. I just know the difference between seeing it and hearing it is way bigger than just hearing. I think you see the interaction among musicians. You see their level of seriousness, too. I mean, I remember the very first time I saw a real jazz performance, I was amazed how serious it was. I mean, not in a grim way, but these guys were like surgeons. You know, they weren't up there hacking around. They were on what they were doing very carefully, and it was an eye-opening experience for me.
Right. No, and it's great what you guys are doing. I mean, how many years have you been? Now I'm going to ask you a question. How many years has Jazz on the Tube been on the internet?
You know, I'm always trying to remember what year we actually started, but I'm going to say 08. I do know I started on January 1st. I just can't remember whether it was 08 or 07. And I just got into this thing of doing one every day, and that made all the difference. You know, it built a following, and we have a lot of people that read the emails every day, check out a lot of the videos,
right.
And it's been good. And we've grown. We actually, I mean, I don't want to brag or anything, but we do get more traffic on the web than Downbeat does. So a lot of people are coming and checking us out.
right. No, it's great. It's great. And
well,
I didn't know you were I didn't know you were a Bronxite, so that even makes it hipper. You know, so.
Yeah. So one of the reasons I wanted to have Bobby on is I'll just tell you my story. You know, I grew up between New Jersey and the Bronx and in the 70s as a high school kid, and in those days people wore their music. You know, they would walk around with these huge boom boxes, and there were radios, it seems like, in every apartment window, and there was just a lot of music in the air. And I heard a lot of Latin music. And, of course, that was one of the golden ages of Latin music, the 70s. And,
right.
But I didn't have an in. You know, you talk about West Side Story. You know, I'm an Irish-Italian kid. You know, there was just no in for me to get into it socially because I was in another world, you know. But
mm-hmm.
I heard it, and I loved it. I always loved it. I always thought it was amazing. And so bit by bit, as I got older, you know, I got into it more and more. And finally, I made my way to Cuba. And when I was in Cuba, it suddenly dawned on me, my God, New York is like one of the greatest centers of Latin music. I call it Afro-Latin music in the world. Like, if you can't make it to Cuba, and not everybody can, if you can make it to New York City, you're going to see some amazing Afro-Latin music. So, and the irony is, a lot of people who even live in New York, who may even be into music, just aren't aware of the riches, not only the current riches, but also the historical riches of New York City and our beloved Bronx, El Bronx, you know, which is a major, major cultural center on the planet that doesn't get its due, you know, for all kinds of various reasons. It's never good to be near the capital of the world, you know. If you're right next to the capital of the world, you don't get – you know, it wasn't good to be Irish next to the British Empire, you know. It didn't help
Irish people
at all. And I feel like the Bronx is kind of in the same position. You know, they're a little too close to the center of the empire to get their due. But, Bobby, you grew up in the Bronx, and your bio says you were right in the Fort Apache section of the South Bronx.
Right. My parents are Puerto Rican. They met at a house party, and I believe it was 1955, 56, they met, and they fell in love. And when I was born and my sister was born, Joanne, we lived on Fox Street in the South Bronx. And then finally, you know, we moved up. In those days, it was considered a privilege to move up into the projects, into the housing projects.
Mm-hmm.
That everybody knows about. And we first lived in 281 Cortland Avenue and East 153rd Street in the Melrose Projects. And then we moved up when I was like 4 or 5 to another. We moved to another building, a bigger apartment in 681 on the corner of, right on the corner of East 153rd Street and Cortland Avenue. 281, I'm sorry, was on Morris Avenue and East 153rd Street. So we went up the hill to East 153rd and Cortland Avenue, 681. And that's where I grew up. And I grew up, unfortunately, you had this weird dichotomy. I was born in 1957, June 2nd, which was the year of West Side Story, the year of Sputnik. A lot of things happened that year, you know. There was incredible things happening musically, artistically, everywhere. And I saw at that time the Bronx was a paradise in terms of people that were working class becoming upwardly mobile. The South Bronx particularly, there was, besides the growing Puerto Rican community, the African American community, the great migration from down south, people from moving from Harlem, and the next thing would be to move to the Bronx because there was affordable private houses available, residential housing in the Bronx at that time, particularly in the South Bronx. And it was a multiracial community. We had, besides African Americans and Puerto Ricans, as I said, we had big Irish community in the South Bronx, Italian community, big Jewish community in the South Bronx. and the remnants, believe it or not, of a German community in the, mm-hmm. the South Bronx, because people don't realize we had German beer halls in the South Bronx and beer refineries in the South Bronx. And the South Bronx also had probably more piano factories than any other place in the United States at the time. So I grew up in that period, and then by 1960, the Cross Bronx Expressway and the Bruckner Expressway were finally completed, and that was the beginning of the end for the South Bronx, because all those communities that I mentioned were displaced. You're talking about almost 1 million people being displaced in the Bronx because of that, because to build these highways that cut through the heart of the South Bronx, they had to, the city claimed eminent domain, and they gave everybody 3 months to move. And there was a cap. If you had a house, there was a cap on the money that they gave you. I think it was $5,000 or whatever. It didn't matter how much your house was worth. The city said, this is all we're going to give you, and that's it. You got to move. Eminent domain. You got to move. No ifs, ands, or buts. At the same time, they were dynamite blasting to create the highway in the evenings, at night, and everything. So, the asthma rates in the South Bronx went astronomical because all this dust was flying around, et cetera, et cetera. It was just crazy. And that, little by little, that started affecting the whole South Bronx, because once those highways were built, the property, the banks redlined the South Bronx. You couldn't get loans if you owned like a tenement. And a lot of the tenements in the South Bronx were close to, becoming 100 years old at the time.
Right.
And so they had to be maintained. So if you owned a tenement and you needed a new boiler for it, you'd go to the bank, ask for a loan, and the bank would turn you down, say, no, we that area's redlined. We can't give you any loans. The property values have gone down, et cetera, et cetera. So many unscrupulous landlords started burning the buildings to collect the insurance money. On top of that, the Vietnam War was happening. Many GIs were coming back to the South Bronx, and they were coming back as drug addicts, as junkies. And organized crime in East Harlem decided to flood the South Bronx with heroin. So you had that element happening, okay? And it was basically a nightmare scenario that the capper was, the city had this guy, Roger Starr, who started working in the Lindsay administration as an advisor, an economic and housing advisor. And they had designs already on the South Bronx and said, well, the guys were chomping at the bit in terms, builders were chomping at the bit. They wanted to like basically raise the South Bronx and rebuild it with new buildings, et cetera. Not realizing that, look, there's a community here. There's a vibrant community that's been here for generations, et cetera. A multiracial community that is very vibrant, et cetera, and represents various cultures. So Roger starts to, say, well, these guys meeting, politicians, builders, et cetera, Roger started meeting. How are we going to get rid of these people from the South Bronx? And Roger Starr came up with this idea called planned shrinkage, which is, his idea was cut services to a particular area that's populated, and the people will become disgusted and leave. Well, mm-hmm. What do you mean by cutting services? Well, close down hospitals, close down police precincts, close down firehouses, and stop garbage collection, stop sanitation collection in the areas. And they instituted that in the South Bronx, and that was the coup de grace. I mean, it became very, very scary. But to my parents and others, I really have to give it to them, and many others of their contemporaries at the time period, they said, no, we're staying. This is our home. We're not leaving. And we survived all of that craziness. Can you imagine there's a fire going on and there's no fire trucks coming to put out the fire? Or if they get there too late because they're coming from another side of, of town, because the firehouse that was nearby was closed down.
And that was daily. That was like a daily occurrence. This wasn't like every now and then that would happen. That was like something that happened regularly. It was the normal.
Yeah, and I always say we were lucky, me and my sister, because we grew up in the projects. They couldn't really burn down a project.
Right.
But they tried. I remember one time distinctly, somebody threw put gasoline on a mattress and threw it in the hallway of a stairwell to smoke out the building. And we lived on the 12th floor, and there was smoke coming underneath the door. Now, anybody that grew up in the projects knows that there's a sticker on the door that says, "In case of fire, do not open this door. It may save your life." You know, so that means, because if you open the door, you'll get the backdraft. So the smoke's coming out. My sister's screaming, and I said, "Get some wet towels, put it on the bottom." So we just waited, and about half an hour later, finally, we hear a knocking on the door, and a guy went in an oxygen mask. "It's the New York City Fire Department. Anybody in there?" And I go, yeah, stay inside. Somebody lit a mattress in the stairwell. You know, stay inside. Don't come out. You know, we'll let you know when you're cooking them out. So that was the kind of craziness we lived in at the time. And then I remember distinctly, we used to live, you know, because we lived on the 12th floor, we could oversee the South Bronx, the surrounding area. And we used to, it was like a nightly ritual, looking out the window and counting the fires every night. It was pretty sad. It was pretty sad.
And the point that you made earlier, I want to make sure everybody gets this. This was a healthy, functioning, productive neighborhood before all this official craziness. And this was imposed from the outside. This wasn't the community disintegrating. This was the community being under siege. And I think people that have heard, you've explained this as well as anybody I've ever heard explain all the different things that happened. What people see in the South Bronx was, after all these things happened, the forced relocation, the redlining, the landlords setting fire to their own buildings to collect the insurance and get out, the lack of services. I mean, because the problem is, when people think South Bronx, they think, oh, well, you know, that place is just crazy. You know, well, yeah, any place that's under siege and, you know, essentially being bombed. I mean, nobody dropped bombs from the air, but they might as well have with what they were doing on the official level. So, yeah, of course, a community is going to be under duress under that circumstance. But before all that, these were functioning neighborhoods. There were a lot of clubs. There was a lot of music. There was a vibrant music scene, right?
Oh, yeah. Let me tell you something. The South Bronx, Mark Nason, the head of African American Studies at Fordham University, says that in no other place have more forms of music been nurtured than in the South Bronx. The only other place possibly is New Orleans, in the Tremaine neighborhood in New Orleans. But the South Bronx we had about 65 to 75 nightclubs. We had these incredible dance halls. We had a burgeoning theater scene that rivaled Manhattan. It was amazing. The Bronx was the place to be. And many great musicians lived in the South Bronx area. You're talking about people like Maxine Sullivan, the great vocalist, Henry Red Nichols, the trumpet player, Elmo Hope, the piano player, Thelonious Monk, used to live in the Bronx. I just saw T.S. Monk a few weeks ago, and we were talking about that. He, you know, when he was a little kid growing up in the Bronx, and all the street games we used to play, people like Eddie Palmieri, Charlie Palmieri, Ray Barreto, the salsa scene, forget it, was incredible in the Bronx. Most of the major musicians that were part of the salsa explosion of the 1970s in New York City either lived or came from the South Bronx. It was just amazing. You'd walk down the street and you'd see, in the projects that I grew up in, the Melrose Projects, there was this great drummer and timbala player, Candido Rodriguez, who was playing with the hottest band at the time, Ricardo Rey and Bobby Cruz, that band. And he lived in the projects, and his wife did my mother's hair. And then this gentleman, Caco, who was a fantastic timbala player, he was part of the Alegre All-Stars, which was the rival group to the Fania All-Stars. Alegre was a record company. Fania, for your listeners, was the largest company, or became the largest company, recording salsa, which is basically Afro-Cuban-based dance music, the way we play it in New York. And they had an all-star band. Both companies had all-star bands made up of their band leaders. Well, Caco was the embajador for the Alegre All-Stars. He lived in the projects that I grew up in, and I used to... I used to see him all the time in the street and play basketball with his nephews. And then Howard King, who was going to Music and Art High School, he was 16, 17. He lived in the projects, also in the Melrose Projects. I used to see him. He was a friend of my cousin, John Collado. And Howard King, you know, was playing with McCoy Tyner and with Gary Bartz at the time, drums. So that's just an example just in my neighborhood alone. So, and these people were local heroes to us because they lived right in the community.
And how did you come to music yourself, and then how did you end up at Berklee?
Well, that's the dichotomy that I'm talking about. While all this madness is going on, right? And I must say, it was caused by one person. The ground zero for it was Robert Moses, the architect. He was the one that created this madness, this dystopia in the South Bronx. If you want to read about him, there's a famous book by Robert Carroll called The Power Broker. It's a very thick book, and every architectural and urban planning student and social studies student in college has to read that book as a requirement. So it's called The Power Broker, and there's a big, thick chapter on how he destroyed the South Bronx by building the Cross Bronx Expressway and building the Bruckner Expressway, and began the end of this glorious period in the South Bronx. But while all this craziness was going on, it was the most incredible time period for jazz, Latin music, pop music, rock music, R&B, soul, funk, all these forms of music on the radio. And it was the last time period, as you well know, where jazz was part of mainstream American TV, where you had a jazz orchestra at the house band on the Johnny Carson Tonight Show, the David Frost Show. Doc Severinsen was the musical director for the Tonight Show. The David Frost Show, Dr. Billy Taylor, the pianist, was the musical director for that big band. Merv Griffin had a small jazz combo on his TV show, on his TV talk show. All the cartoons had jazz in them, from the Flintstones to the Jetsons to, Johnny Quest. All those Hanna-Barbera cartoons, the theme songs and all the music was written by a jazz musician who was a pianist named Hoyt Curtin. And if you want to really check out some hip jazz, check out the theme songs of all those cartoons that I mentioned. He wrote basically all the music for Hanna-Barbera. And he wrote it from a jazz perspective, you know. So go to YouTube and you can look him up and look up all those cartoons I mentioned. My favorite theme song is the Johnny Quest theme song. For that cartoon. It has a really incredibly hard trombone part, you know, that Frank Rossellino plays. You know,
wow.
The great trombonist. You might want to do a jazz on the tube on cartoons.
I'm going to look into that. I mean, my favorite as a kid was the Woody Woodpecker song.
Yeah, bebop. It's bebop.
And then I realized later as an adult, that was bebop. I was digging bebop when I was 5 years old. I didn't know what it was.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
All this was happening.
Go ahead.
So all this was happening, and you were a kid just, you know, absorbing it. And did you have any family members that were musicians, or how did you realize that?
No, but music was part of my complete... My father was an avid music lover. He passed away last year, and he was my first musical education because he worked as a machinist in Long Island, in Valley Stream, Long Island. So he took him 2 hours to get there and 2 hours to come back from work. So his ritual was he bought himself a Lazy Boy chair. He would sit in that Lazy Boy chair after he ate dinner and listen to music. And he would smoke a cigarette and drink a Schaefer beer because Schaefer was the sponsor for the New York Yankees. He was a Yankee fan. So he'd drink Schaefer beer, smoke a cigarette, and listen to music. And my mother would tell me, just sit there if you want with your next to your father, you know, and do your homework. And I would listen to what he would listen to. So he would listen to Harry Belafonte live at Carnegie Hall. He'd listen to Sergio Mendez at Brazil 66. He listened to Machito. He listened to Puerto Rican folk music forms. He listened to ranchera music from Mexico. He listened to this artist, I remember her distinctly. Every Puerto Rican had one of her recordings, Lola Flores, who was from Spain. She sang a style of music called Bolero Morunos, which is where these flamenco-influenced boleros, love songs. And so I was growing up with all of that stuff at the same time, and then the radio at the same time. The first recordings that I remember ever hearing, and these were because of my father, I remember listening to Dobie Gray, I'm In With the In Crowd, Reach Out by the Four Tops, and what else? Recuerdos de Navidad, which was a song by a guaracha by a group from Puerto Rico called Trio Vega Bajeño. And also I distinctly remember when he brought home Más Que Nada by Sergio Mendez in Brazil 66 on a 45. And I loved it immediately because there was the funky piano licks that Sergio Mendez played, and they were very bluesy. I didn't even know what blues was at the time. I was a little kid, you know. So,
sure.
But later on I found out that Sergio Mendez was a big fan of Horace Silver. That's why he played the way he did. And I remember asking my father, hey, Pop, you know, like, how come it sounds like they're singing in Spanish, but it's a little bit different with the accent and everything. He says, come over here. He takes out the globe, sits me on his knee, and he starts showing me Brazil. Then he starts showing me Africa. Then he starts showing me Spain. And then he starts showing me Portugal. And then he starts showing me where Puerto Rico is on the globe and everything. So he's connecting all the dots, and he says, look, the people in Brazil speak a language called Portuguese from this place, Portugal. And I go, well, how come they speak, you know, Portuguese? And, you know, then he starts talking about the slave trade and everything else. And so he's giving me a little history lesson at the same time that he's showing me about the culture of Brazil and the differences, but also the things in common that we have. And the one thing in common that we have is Africa in terms of our rhythmic roots. And then he starts talking about the melodies and everything that, you know, the harmony and everything comes from Europe, but mixed in with African-based rhythm. So my father was probably the greatest teacher I've ever had, and he passed away last year. And I miss him dearly.
Sorry.
Yeah, yeah. And besides him, you know, moving forward to high school, Mr. William Ryan, who was my high school band director, he showed me what it was to be a professional musician. And then Keith Copeland was the finality of this beautiful eternal triangle, I call it. He was the teacher at Berklee College of Music when I was a student, who really made me a professional drummer. He really, because of him, I can make a living in this business.
Mm-hmm.
So, parenthetically, all three of them died one after the other. First, it was Keith that passed away, then Mr. Ryan, and then my father, all within a 3-month period last year. So,
wow,
it's pretty prophetic. It was like they were all saying goodbye at the same time.
That's a lot of loss altogether.
Yeah.
So now you were I think I read that you were the first Puerto Rican to attend Berklee?
Yeah. I mean, when I was there, there were no Puerto Ricans, nobody. And believe me, I looked for them. I looked far and wide. I looked for anybody that spoke Spanish, nobody. I mean, there was a philosophy teacher we had I can't remember his name, but he had a Jewish last name, right? Mm-hmm. So there I am at Berklee. Nobody speaks Spanish. Eventually found a couple of Brazilians that were there. And my roommate, David Carmona, was Costa Rican. He went to high school with me. He was in high school band. He was a trumpet player. He was the one that told me about the Berklee College of Music, because we were the only two people in the high school band that were serious about music. Everybody else took high school band because they wanted to get out of gym. But we were the only two. And Mr. Ryan, God bless him, he knew that we were serious about music, and he knew we were going to audition for Berklee. He goes, listen, you're never going to pass the theory exam with the little that you know. I'll make a deal with you. Come like twice a week, three times a week after school, and I'll give you a free theory lesson afterwards, like for an hour, half an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So because of him and his kindness, we were able to somewhat past the exams to get into the school and the auditions. which were pretty rigorous at the time. Things have completely changed. But yeah, because of Mr. Ryan, we were able to get into the school. And then, what was I lost my train of thought, but...
How the whole issue of you were the only Spanish-speaking student in Berkeley.
So David was, who was of Costa Rican descent, we were roommates. We became roommates. And then because of him, I knew about the school. And the reason I knew about the school was because, like, as I said, I walked into class one day. I would get there early for band class so I could play a little bit on the snare drum by myself. But he was already there playing, warming up on trumpet. But he had a book he was reading. And it said Berklee College of Music. And I go, hey, man, what's that? He goes, man, this is the best jazz school in the country. Quincy Jones went here. Chick Corea went here, this, that, and the other. I go, really? And he goes... So I started looking, check it out. So I started looking at it, and I see a picture of a guy with a conga drum in a rehearsal in there. Later on, and you don't see the guy's face or anything, but later on, it was a black and white photo, and later on, I would find out years later, you know who that was? That was Don Elias.
Oh, no kidding.
yeah, from the Boston. He was studying medicine, biochemistry or something in Boston at the time. I forgot what college. But he would go to rehearsals at Berklee when they needed a conga player or something. I met him years later, and he goes, yeah, man, that was that picture, that's me, you know.
That's great.
My whole life has been these moments of, like, 6 degrees of separation. But,
right.
I cherish all of them. But so
there's a
when
great
I got
interview.
There – yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, go. I'm sorry for this sidebar, but there's a great interview with Don, who's passed away too, unfortunately, and about the sessions with Miles Davis on Bitches Brew.
Right, right.
And have you ever heard that interview?
Yeah. Well, he talks about that he learned this rhythm in New Orleans that Jack DeJohnette, he was trying to get Jack DeJohnette, Miles was trying to get Jack DeJohnette to play it, or he was trying to show him, or whatever.
Yeah.
And Don knew how to do it, you know, so.
Right. And then and there's another funny thing that cracked me up. At some point, not that rehearsal, but another rehearsal, Miles just leaned over to him and said, play that Afro-Cuban shit, man. I love it.
Yeah. Which to me is an irony, because as far as I know, he never did anything like that. I mean, the closest he got to was incorporating percussionists in his fusion bands. But according to what Latin musicians from that era told me, Miles, you know, didn't dig, you know, the music of Machito and all these other groups, you know, like he didn't embrace it for some reason. But I guess later on he embraced it, you know, in his own way.
When he got older and wiser. So then you ended up, so now you're in Berklee and you're going through that excellent program. Now you mentioned in your letter to me that it's really changed, that Berklee has a lot of Latin students now.
Oh yeah, that's the highest population of students at Berklee is Latinos from all over Latin America, all the 22 countries in Latin America. There's some great musicians. I can name one for you right now, Nacho Gonzalez, who's a guitarist from Uruguay, and he's a great young composer and arranger. And we've played some of his music here in New York City with the Manhattan School of Music Afro-Cuban Jazz Orchestra. Because every couple of semesters we do a concert called New Works for Latin Jazz Orchestra. And we premiere New Works. So we've recently premiered a couple of his compositions. And the way I met him, you know how I met him? 2 years ago at Gen at the Jazz Education Network Conference. So if I hadn't gone to the conference, which at that time was in Louisville, Kentucky 2 years ago, I never would have known about him. Then I met another musician, Socrates Garcia, who teaches at the University, I believe, of North Dakota. He is Dominican and fabulous musician. He's a guitarist, and he is a great composer and arranger of big band music. And I heard some of his jazz merengue compositions, and I introduced myself. And parenthetically, we were doing a concert. I was preparing a concert in tribute to the Dominican Republic. And I go, I'm pinching myself and talking to myself. I said, this can't be true, man. I mean, he's, you know, I meet the right person at the right time. It's because I went to the conference, the Jazz Education Network's conference. So there goes another reason why everybody should join GEN and attend the conference.
You know,
you can join the organization also as a non-musician. But as a non-musician, as you well know, if you go down there to the conference, it's amazing because it's just you're in jazz heaven for like 3 or 4 days, just constantly from the 9 o'clock in the morning to like midnight. It's all concerts, all these varieties of concerts, educational presentation. So that's how I met those two gentlemen. And they represent the tip of the iceberg in terms of what's being brought forth in terms of Latin musicians that are doing things with jazz. So I always say the future of jazz is in Latin America.
I couldn't agree more. And what's amazing is that it's all this flourishing is taking place without any obvious external or organizational or institutional support. You know, I mean, you know, everybody's scrambling and finding a place to stand on to do their work. But, you know, why isn't there a really, maybe there is, maybe I've missed it. Why isn't there a really good Latin jazz magazine? Why isn't there a really, really good Latin jazz website that covers the news in great detail? You know what I mean?
There have been attempts. I mean, there's a gentleman who's on the web right now, Chip Boaz, who's a high school jazz educator, a junior high school jazz educator in on the West Coast in the San Francisco Bay Area, Oakland area. And he's a presence. He had a website called the Latin Jazz Corner, and he had weekly articles and reviews of recordings, interviews, et cetera. And he was really being forthright in that, but it was just all, as you know, running jazz on the tube, it's very time consuming and just took so much out of it. I mean, but he took a break and now he's reappearing again on the scene. So I would go to he has a Facebook page, both a personal one, Chip Boaz, and B-O-A-Z-C-H-I-P is his first name. And he has the Latin Jazz Corner on Facebook. And then there was the Latin Jazz at Yahoo Groups discussion group, which is still in existence, but it's also in existence on Facebook. That kind of had a glory period, I would say, you know, like 2006, 7, 8, around there, where there was a massive traffic on that website, people discussing the music, et cetera. And there were some great musicians talking about the music, et cetera. So that's kind of all been transferred down to Facebook. But you're right. I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, we need more of the mainstream jazz community to embrace the music and write more about it. And which brought us together, you know, with this conversation over that, the New York Times article, that recent article, because there are always, every once in a while, there's an article. Somebody writes an article every once in a blue moon. And then, but usually the articles, although they're well-intended, they always leave things out. And that's what brought me to when you posted that article, and I saw it, actually a colleague of mine, friend, made me aware of the article beforehand. But when you posted it, I had written a response on Facebook to the posting of the article, and I just cut and pasted it and sent it to you when you posted it. So that's what actually brought us to this conversation that we're having right now.
Yeah, and you made a couple of points. You know, one is, why does the New York Times only talk about this once in a blue moon? And two, while they're giving some attention to some musicians, which is great, the overwhelming majority of them are not getting any coverage at all.
Right. I would say to your listeners is, whenever you read something in the jazz world, that's just the tip of the iceberg. Like whenever you look at Downbeat Magazine, whenever you look at Jazz Times, whenever you look at Inside Jazz, which is a local magazine in New York City, or Hot House Magazine, which is another local jazz magazine in New York City, keep in mind that always in the back of your head, well, I'm reading about this artist, or I'm reading about this recording, or I'm reading about this venue right now, but this is just the tip of the iceberg. So I'm not just saying that about the Latin jazz scene, but about every scene related to jazz. Most people would think, oh, there's nobody doing any more jazz rock, or what we call fusion music anymore. There's tons of people experimenting with that still to this day, but you just don't hear about it because for whatever reason, the writers aren't writing about it. And writers are just human beings like everybody else. And they, depending on their age, their life experiences, and their personal preferences, they'll write about only specific things. And it's our job to make people aware of, it shouldn't be our job, but, you know, unfortunately it is, you know, to like people like myself every once in a while say, hey, you know, that's all well and good that you wrote that, but you're leaving out a lot of important details. And
sure,
that's what,
exactly.
I mean, that's why we're having this conversation.
Hey, let's talk about some of the institutions that you're involved in that are doing good work in this area. Of course, Manhattan School of Music. Talk about their investment in, you know, Latino and African American Afro Latin music.
I have to thank Justin DeChocho for that, the former head of the Manhattan School of Music, who just retired. He just left his position at the school in December. He brought me into the school about, what was it, like 22 years ago, 21 years ago, 20 years ago, I have to really check. But at the time, believe it or not, I was teaching at the Berklee College of Music, my alma mater, and I was teaching drums and percussion there. I would fly in on a Monday morning, teach 10 hours, and fly back on a Monday night.
Wow.
And it was just exhausting. I couldn't do it anymore. I did it for about a year. And I said, this is crazy. I mean, this is nuts. You know, I can't do this, you know. So when I let them know that I couldn't do it anymore, parenthetically, like, believe it or not, the next day I got a call from Justin DeChocho. And he didn't even know I was teaching at the Berklee College of Music. That's why I talk about these 6 degree of separation moments, et cetera, or these moments, I guess you call it kismet or fate or whatever. Mm-hmm. He calls me up and he says to me, listen, I want to start a Latin jazz orchestra at the school, and I think you're the best guy to do it. And I told him that I had just finished leaving a position at the Berklee College of Music. And the last thing at Berklee that I did before I left the position was they asked me to put together a concert in honor of Tito Puente. But they wanted me to do it with the orchestra at the school that Phil Wilson was teaching. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'll do the concert, but under one stipulation. I don't want the Phil Wilson Orchestra. I want the whole orchestra made up of the best Latino students that you have available at the school.
Mm.
Because their voice needs to be heard. And I've always been like that, forthright in that kind of thing, in terms of, you should call it advocacy or activism. So, and they said, sure, no problem. And it was great because I got to meet all these young players that I had no idea. I knew they were there at the school, but because I was, you know, in the bowels of the percussion department teaching all day, you know, for those 10 hours, I never met any of them. So I finally got to meet him. The concert was great. I put together a whole slide presentation on Tito Puente's life and history, et cetera, et cetera. So I left the school, you know, with that little, like, imprint. And then when Justin called me and I said, man, I just finished, you know, I was teaching at the Berklee College of Music. He goes, I didn't know that, you know, this, that, and the other. So I said, well, you know, I'm kind of burnt out from teaching there, and I'm teaching at the new school, an orchestra there on Tuesday. He goes, well, look, the position is open. Think about it, you know, but you got to call me within the next day or two because I'm thinking of some other people if you don't want to do it. So I talked to some friends, and they said, Bobby, I know you're a little burnt out, but listen, you're going to be kicking yourself in the head if you don't do it, because who's more qualified to do it than you? Nobody,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I called him up the next day, and I said, you know, great. He said, great. Then later on, he admitted to me, listen, I wasn't thinking of anybody else. But I was, you know, hoping that you would say yes. You know, so and so that's, you know, that's how I started this teaching at the Manhattan School of Music. Then, I must say the school has been very supportive. And they've really made me a better teacher because every semester I have to put together these theme concerts. In the beginning, I just put together the concerts the way I envisioned them in terms of, well, I'll do a little bit of this, a little bit of that, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And it started off with me using music that I had performed with Mario Balzar's Afro-Cuban Jazz Orchestra, which Mario was the father of this genre, Afro-Cuban Jazz, and I was his drummer for 10 years. So I started utilizing that music and then some published things that I would see online or in catalogs that I knew, go, wow, this arrangement looks interesting. But then when I would get them, I noticed that the arrangers had no idea, had no knowledge of clave, But I would use them in an educational way, you know, because I would bring them in and I'd tell the students, everybody take out their pencils. Okay, bar 15. Move that eighth note on the end of one, or move it to the end of two. Do this, do that, you know, putting everything in clave, you know, as we say, because that's the mantra that we live by in Afro-Cuban music, Puerto Rican and Dominican music. So it was an way for me to educate the students about what we call clave consciousness. And because in Cuban, Puerto Rican, and Dominican music, we're judged how we circumnavigate clave. But in jazz, we're judged how we circumnavigate harmony. And most in jazz musicians, if you meet them, talk to them, you know, or if you listen in on a conversation with them when they're talking about music, they're always talking about harmony. And with us, it's rhythm. So jazz musicians are supremely ignorant of the complexities rhythmically of this music. It's getting better, but it still shouldn't be as bad, the lack of knowledge, as it is.
Well, I heard somebody, I can't remember who it was that said this, but I think he was right on the money. He said, it's easy, you know, easy in quotes, for Latin-trained musicians to learn jazz. It's not so easy the other way around. It's not
right,
so
I think
easy
Tito
for Puente
musicians said that.
To learn jazz.
Yeah,
I
think Tito Puente was the one that said that, yeah. You know, I've said it before too.
It's a much more complex music. There's more learn. Now I'm embarrassed to say I didn't realize you were Mario Bauza's drummer for 10 years.
Yeah, I did all those albums with him. You know,
my god!
His comeback album, which was called Tanga, Mario Bauza and his Afro-Cuban Jazz Orchestra, did 944 Columbus Avenue. And the final album, which was called My Time Is Now. So,
now, he's an example. We'll know that Latin jazz is getting its due when every jazz fan knows and appreciates who Mario Bauza was.
Oh, of course, but it's the same thing. It's like there's several reasons for that they don't know. One is ignorance, and two is, I hate to say it, bigotry, and three, prejudice, because the irony of the jazz musician, I've always said this, the irony of the jazz musician is that we are the most open-minded in terms of embracing other elements into the music.
Yeah.
But we are also the most closed-minded and parochial at times, because when you get jazz fans together, you know, like, for example, talk to a jazz fan about the recent Grammy telecast. First thing out of their mouth probably is going to be, again, the same crap, you know, they put down whatever's being telecast. But, you know, or you get what I call the bebop Nazis. So the people that just are into bebop and everything else sucks, right?
Right.
And, you know, and I must say, at certain periods in my life, I was like that as well. But luckily, I grew out of that immaturity, you know? I mean, so you remember we were talking about Miles before and how he wasn't into the music at all.
Right.
And until finally later, every time you saw Miles' band, he always had a percussionist, or sometimes multiple percussionists in his band. But he wasn't ready for that in the 50s, or the 60s at all, whatever, you know. But who knows? Maybe it was because he had two left feet and couldn't dance. I don't know. I mean,
but he was a boxer, though.
I think you
made a good point. I mean, it's kind of an issue of maturation. You know, we kind of, when we're young, we grab onto something and that becomes our identity. And then we get older and we get a little more, I don't know, looser about understanding the world is more complicated than we realize. And there's a lot more riches in the world than we realized when we were younger.
Right.
And I think that might have been the case with him, too. Hey, could you tell us a little bit about the Bronx? Is the Bronx?
Oh, hold on. Let me finish off with this thing, because
please, go ahead.
About the racism and the bigotry and everything. And
please do. Yeah.
Latin musicians that playing jazz have always been looked at as stepchildren, and people don't realize that we've been part of this music since jazz's creation. You have to realize New Orleans is the northernmost Caribbean city, and if you look at it things from that perspective, it's only natural that Latin rhythms, particularly Afro-Cuban and Afro-Puerto Rican, rhythms would be part of the mix in New Orleans. And you hear it clearly in second lines. The clave is there. When you hear the street parades and the snare drum patterns, cowbell patterns that they use, bass drum patterns, et cetera, et cetera. And Cuba and New Orleans always had that connection. You know, you had that triangular trade route between Mexico, Panama, New Orleans, and Cuba. So Latin music, Latin rhythms have always been part of the mix in New Orleans. But because of prejudice, bigotry, racism, you know, xenophobia, et cetera, et cetera, and, you know, and this kind of unfettered pride that jazz musicians have sometimes, which shoots, in my opinion, cuts our noses to spite our faces. If you're not from a certain camp of the jazz tradition, you look down upon everything else. Mm-hmm. Like, Machito is one of the greatest jazz orchestras that have ever existed. But if you talk to a jazz musician, they'll tell you, oh, yeah, but that's Latin music, man, you know?
Right.
I go, yeah, but that's part of the continuum, man. Don't you know that this is part of the continuum of the jazz tradition? Don't you know that, you know? He goes, or they'll say something like, oh, that's that Latin shit, you know?
Yep.
To use an expletive.
I mean, yeah.
And he goes, no, you don't understand, man. This is part of the tree. In fact, this branch of the tree is closer to the trunk than any other branch.
Exactly. That's a really important point. Yeah. Yeah. And
our rhythms come directly from Africa. Yeah. So
right.
Yeah,
and you can hear that much more clearly in Puerto Rican and Cuban music than you can hear in jazz. I mean, if you know what to listen for, you will hear it in jazz, but
right,
you have to be a little educated. But you just hear it right away in Cuba. But you did a post on YouTube, or somebody posted it, with you doing a drumming demo, and you demoed going straight from clave, you slid right into second line, and it was seamless.
Right.
I'll tell you that you might consider doing another version of that and really, I don't know, making a production out of it, because
I'd love to do that. Yeah, I mean, from your mouth to God's ears. I mean, I want to do it the right way in a theater, because I've done this. That was a little clip from, because I was promoting for PBS 4-hour documentary called Latin Music USA, and they flew me into this TV convention that was in Los Angeles, where everybody from all the networks gets together and promotes their shows. So I was there, and they asked me to do that. Hey, can you do something about the music in 5 minutes or less, or 6 minutes? I started laughing. I said, sure, man. You know, and that's what that little excerpt is that you're talking about. But I'd love to do that in a theater with projections behind me, because I've done that where it's like a half hour long, where I'm talking about Africa, Spain, the transatlantic migration, you know, everything, you know. So, but that's from your mouth to God's ear. So maybe somebody listening will call me up and say, hey, I'd like to help you do that, you know, produce that.
Well,
there has to be somebody knows about production. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, it's out there now. It's out there. And I think that would, that could be one of the most valuable things ever done to help bridge this mental gap. I mean, there is no gap between Latin music and jazz and reality. There's no gap. It's just a mental gap. And I think once people see a demonstration like what you did on the drums, they'll instantly realize, oh my God, this is the, well, you know, Mario Bauza said this. It's one of my favorite quotes. We all speak the same language. We just speak with different accents.
Right, exactly. Mario was a very wise man, and Dizzy was a wise man. He knew that also. But the problem is that because of, and what is the main cause of bigotry and racism? The main cause of it is fear.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been taught to fear each other, and we really have more things in common than differences, which has always been my message. And so when Chano Pozo was recommended to Dizzy by Mario Bauza, and they came together and they collaborated together, it was like Chano Pozo said, you know, Dizzy no speak no Spanish, me no speak no English, but we both speak African. So,
mm-hmm.
And that's what Dizzy, one of Dizzy's greatest contributions was that when he looked at, when he met Mario Bazar, when they mm-hmm. were in their salad days, well, Mario was already an established trumpet player, having played with Noble Sissle and Don Redman and Chick Webb and Cab Calloway, and Mario becomes friends with Dizzy, and they're both roommates in Cab Calloway's band, and Dizzy starts realizing, wow, the music that Mario comes from, the culture that he comes from, Cuba, is closer to Africa than we are as African Americans. I need to get back, I need to get that element back into jazz.
And, right.
You know, he knew that. He was, you know, Dizzy and Mario were basically ground zero as far as being world musicians, in my opinion. And, you know, Dizzy loved, Dizzy didn't just love Cuban music. He loved Brazilian music. He loved music of all cultures. And of all of the avatars of bebop, who are the five main avatars of bebop? Dizzy, Bird, Max Roach, Thelonious Monk. Who else?
Bud.
Miles.
Bud Powell.
Bud Powell, you know. Those guys, there's only one of them that embraced Afro-Cuban music fully, and then all world music. There's only one of them, Dizzy.
Well, unfortunately, a lot of them didn't get a chance to live long enough to really develop everything they could have developed, you know. But you know, don't forget, Bud had some Latin numbers that were pretty good.
Oh, yeah, with Poco Loco and things like that. Yeah. But
in terms
of really, really diving in and getting into the music, like, and then continuing that throughout their whole career. I mean, I guess you could say Max, when he started the M Boom Percussion Ensemble, which, by the way, I'm the newest member of that ensemble. That ensemble still exists. M Boom. Yeah.
Oh, how do you like that? Okay.
Yeah. So anyway,
Max got to live out his lifespan. You know, Bird and Bud, you know, had so many problems and. So I have a feeling that had they had the chance, who knows where they could have gone. In fact, I want to point something out. If you weren't aware of this, I only discovered it recently. I know you know Steve Coleman, the alto player who's gone down to Cuba a lot. And he wrote a beautiful essay on Charlie Parker where he talks about Parker's work with Machito, which is very much overlooked. And
I must say – and I can say this now because they're both gone. The reason that happened was because Bobby Rodriguez, the bass player for Machito, it was supposed to be Harry Sweets Edison on those recordings, you know. But when they started recording, he couldn't find where one was. He was very intimidated by the Afro-Cuban percussion section and everything. So
yep.
Norman Grant says, this is not working. So, you know, Bobby Rodriguez, you know, the bass player, at the time, besides being a great bass player, he was also a heroin dealer. And Bird was one of his customers. And he goes, hey, I know where Bird is. He's a couple of blocks away at a bar waiting for me. I can go get him. You know, let's see if, you know, so he gets him, and that's how Bird becomes part of those recordings of the. I knew Bobby Rodriguez intimately. He was actually, you know, like, he would tell that story in public all the time, and you know, he was proud of it because he said, look, I'm not proud that I was a junkie, but I'm proud that I kicked that stuff, and I just want people to know, you know, the real deal about that. So then Norman Grant goes, hey, I got a great idea. If we record The Peanut Vendor and Manicero, which was the first authentic Cuban song that people heard in 1930 in the United States when Don Aspiazu and Havana Casino Orchestra traveled from Cuba to New York City to record and play it at a few theaters in New York. If we record The Peanut Vendor, Bird, you with the Machito Orchestra, it'll be a hit. And what does Bird say? I can't do that. And Norman Grant says, like, what do you mean I can't do that? He goes, man, that's authentic Cuban music. I don't know anything about that. You know, I mean, I'll play on the bebop jazz-oriented things Machito has been pulling out, but I'm not going to play that. That's authentic Cuban music. That's folk music, man. I don't know anything about that.
He had the humility. I think it showed, you know, his humility that he knew it was a substantial art form, and he knew he didn't have the background in it.
Yeah, and Norman Grant is telling him, man, it's like two or three chords. What's wrong with you? You know, he goes, hey, man, I'm sorry, man. I respect it too much, you know.
There you go.
Can you imagine? That's besides Bird's humility, his genius too. I mean, so I have much respect for Bird.
And, well, I'll send you the link. If you've never read this article, this essay really that Steve wrote about Bird, he takes 12 Bird solos or Bird performances and really breaks them down. And then he goes into the one with Michito. It's really eye-opening. I'll send you the link if you've never seen it.
Oh, I would love to. I would love to see that. I mean, you know, I know of Steve's background dealing with Cuban musicians and going to Cuba, et cetera. So I'd love to share that with my students. I'm always looking for things like that. And I'll share it with Chip Boas, and he'll definitely put it up on his website and Facebook page. But, you know, it's funny. You're talking about this kind of respect thing. The simplest, people are always asking me for explanations about clave, and I've gotten it to where I can do it in a few minutes to talk about the basic concept of it. But the most profound and simplest explanation that I ever heard for clave was Machito. Somebody asked him once, "Hey, Machito, can you explain what clave is?" And he goes, "Simple, respect."
Wow.
That's the best explanation I can for clave, man. You know.
Wow.
How deep is that, man?
Wow. I got goosebumps from that answer.
Yeah. That's like the one word explanation, man. I mean,
wow.
Imagine if you were doing a thesis on Cuban music for some ethnomusicology class, and you had to give your hand in your paper, your final paper, thesis paper, and it's about clave. You know, and you have the quorum there of the professors looking at you. You know, and they go and you hand in your theorem. I bet they would all start smiling, man. If you just put that, to quote Machito, simple respect.
And it's the kind of thing that you could take that and talk for hours about what it means, you know, and
you'd
never get to the end of it.
Hey,
there's something else that you're involved in, the Bronx Music Heritage Center. Could you just tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah. Well, myself and Elena Martinez, my co-artistic director, and she was the producer of the film From Mambo to Hip Hop, which I think you've shown on Jazz on the Tube. You've put up a link to it.
Yes, I have.
Previously, right. So I became an associate producer for that, and also I was a talking head and researcher for that. And that's how actually me and Elena met. So that film has been, and I would encourage anybody to see it. It's on YouTube. You can see it. It was an award-winning documentary produced by City Lore, which is an incredible organization that documents all the folklore of all the different ethnic groups in New York City. Well, Elena is the chief cultural anthropologist and folklorist there. So this organization, WETCO, Women's Housing Economic Development Corporation, has been around for 25 years. Nancy Bieberman, who is, I guess you could describe her best as a leftist housing lawyer. She's like the leading housing lawyer, one of the leading housing lawyers in the country. 25 years ago, realized through her advocacy and work with women in housing, realized that women were being disenfranchised in the communities, especially in the South Bronx. So she formed this nonprofit, and she bought the old Morris Senior Hospital, which was closed during the Roger Starr era that I talked about with the planned shrinkage. It was closed, this huge hospital in the South Bronx that I remember going to distinctly when I was sick, when my parents were taking me there when I was a kid. It was abandoned. I mean, it was ridiculous. This incredible huge structure just left there, you know, abandoned and by the city. And she, back then you could, through sweat equity, you could buy a building for a dollar. So she buys the building for a dollar and starts applying for grants and everything. Anyways, they rebuild the freaking building, man. And it's beautiful apartments. There's a public school component to it, et cetera. And that's how she started the organization. Then she built another building called IG Interval Green right on Freeman Street in the Morrisania section of the South Bronx, which is where Jimmy Owens grew up, the National Endowment of the Arts Jazz. That's another product of New York City public schools and music education in New York City public schools in the 50s, right near where also where Monk lived and all these other, a lot of other people, Maxine Sullivan, like I mentioned before, lived. Herbie Hancock lived in that neighborhood when he came from Chicago. Donald Byrd lived in, around there. They built this other building, housing development, and it's green. It has it's solar powered on the top, et cetera. So she realized that how do you rebuild neighborhoods? Well, everybody talks about building new buildings, but nobody talks about the culture and rebuilding the culture. And she knew about, she had read an article that Elena had written about the extensive club scene, Latin and jazz club scene that the South Bronx had at one time, and that little fire in her. She had come to see me at performances at the Manhattan School of Music and professionally with my own big band and other groups. And she asked me and Elena to be on the board of advisors of WETCO. And one thing led to another, and she had this plan to build this center that would use music to reinvigorate the culture of the neighborhood. And she got Dr. Mark Nason involved, all the members of our board of advisors, the people like Ray Mantilla, who's also from the South Bronx. And he's the third most recorded conga player in the history of jazz. First is Candido, second is Ray Barreto, and third is Ray Mantilla.
Oh.
And people like Will Calhoun, who's the drummer for Living Color. A lot of people don't know either. He's from the Bronx. Jimmy Owens, who's also from the Bronx, et cetera, et cetera. Maxine Gordon, Dexter Gordon's widow, and many other people. But we have an incredible board of advisors, people from the hip-hop community like Grandmaster Caz, Joe Conza Jr., the photographer, also Circa 95 from the hip-hop community. So she approaches me and Elena and says, I want you to run this place. And it's right now, it's an art gallery space in that Intervale Green building that holds about 100 people. And it's a beautiful art gallery space. We have revolving art exhibitions, three-month basis. But we also have a stage, sound system, everything. And in there, we have concerts, poetry recitals. We've had plays. We've done everything that you could possibly imagine, that's, but all Bronx-centric. So my philosophy is that whenever we do a program at the Bronx Music Heritage Center, I use the philosophy of Bill Graham, who was the manager of Santana and the Grateful Dead and had the famous film All East and West, and he helped to produce Woodstock. His philosophy was always give the people what they want, but also give them what they need.
Mm.
So Bill would do crazy things like he'd have the Woody Herman Big Band opening up for the Grateful Dead. Now, who does that nowadays? What producer would do that today? And that's because Bill, he was a child of World War II. He was in a Nazi concentration camp. But when he finally survived World War II, his family comes to the Bronx. He goes to DeWitt Clinton High School, et cetera, becomes an actor, a social activist, then a theater company director, and then he becomes this big promoter in terms of the world of rock. But he always loved Latin music and jazz. And he always would find ways to incorporate jazz in his concert programming. And then when Santana came along, he says, oh, this is the perfect band, because Bill was also a mambo nick, a lover of mambo in the 50s and a great mambo dancer. If you look at the film Bugsy, he plays, who's the guy? The famous mafia don. What's his name? Lucky Luciano. And there's
okay.
a scene where they're in Cuba. And Warren Beatty plays Bugsy, and while he's beating up some rival of his that disparaged his girlfriend, Mario Bazar's Tanga with the Machito Orchestra is playing in the background. You see Lucky Luciano is played by Bill Graham dancing mambo. You know?
You're kidding.
Yeah, that's Bill Graham. That's Bill Graham in that scene. Yeah, he plays Lucky Luciano. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So
I had no idea of all that background of Bill Graham. That's really amazing.
Yeah, read his biography. He says that the greatest thing that he ever, the greatest accomplishment he ever did was winning the mambo contest at the Palladium Ballroom.
Well, that well, you know what? That was that must have been a pretty big accomplishment, because that was not an easy place to win the mambo award.
right.
That's amazing. I got to read that. I, you know, I as a kid, my family lived in San Francisco for a couple of years, and I used to have to, on my way to school, I'd change for the bus right at Fillmore and Geary, which is where the Fillmore auditorium was. And so I remember I was six, and I would see, or I was seven, actually, and I'd see the Strawberry Alarm Clock, the Jefferson Airplane, the Grateful Dead, all up on the marquee. And I am 7 years old. I couldn't figure out what was going on in that building.
Right.
Wow. Wow.
Amazing, right? So, but and that's why that if you look, anybody that went to the Fillmore, the East and the West, he based the decor, he based the places on the Palladium Ballroom. There was a there was a big ball chandelier on the top, right? There was a stage for the band. But there was always room for dancing, you know. They weren't dancing mambo or anything like that. They were freak dancing or whatever, because everybody was doing LSD back then. But it was there had to be room for you to dance, and that he based it off of the Palladium Ballroom. So there you go. That's another 6 degrees of separation thing. It's
wow,
just so sad because it's just so sad. And then when he. When Santana came along, he said, wow, you know, this is the perfect band. You know, they do blues, they do rock, and they combine it with Afro-Cuban rhythms. So, you know, it was inevitable for him to manage them. And he's the one that got them at Woodstock, because when they appeared at Woodstock, they weren't even signed to CBS at the time. They had just made a few preliminary demos and everything. But when the two gentlemen that I forgot their names, that were producing Woodstock, and they were in over their heads, they said, man, we got to get Bill Graham involved in this because he really knows what to do. He told them, okay, I'll help you, but you got to have my band play. You got to give them a slot. And he goes, what band is that? He goes, the Santana band, the Santana Blues Band. He goes, well, let me hear a tape. And then he sends them a tape, and turns out that the gentleman, that the main promoter of Woodstock, his father had owned a nightclub that had booked Tito Puente, Machito, and you know, had Latin dancing there. So when he heard the music, he felt, you know, he said, oh, man, this is like the music my father used to book. This is great. So another 6 degrees of separation, and how people, their cultural history informs them to make the right decision. Because maybe somebody else would have heard the tape, and he goes, what is this, man? Congas and cowbells and everything with rock music. I don't understand this stuff. But that gentleman, you know, again, I forgot his name. He'll come to me in a second, hopefully. He right away, he related it to his cultural history. Oh, yeah, my father. You know, he used to book Puente and Machito, and I love this music, you know, this, that, and the other. And there you go.
Cool. So he had that little exposure as a kid that opened up his ears, sort of taking all this full circle, you know. When people hear this music and spend some time with it, they get it. And so the challenge is to get people to listen to it, or give not get people to listen to it, just give them an opportunity to hear it. So that's why we opened a whole channel on Jazz on the Tube. We're focusing on Cuba because, you know, Cuba's been out of the limelight for so many decades, you know.
Right.
But we're putting a lot of other Latin music in there. We also have a Latin venue, Afro-Latin music venues in New York City, and I've got 10 venues listed there. I'm going to send you the link, and if I've left something out, I really would appreciate you telling us, because, you know, that's the best way. New Yorkers have no idea, and people who are also visiting New York, which is a lot of people these days, a lot of them have no idea that when they're in New York, they're in one of the great Latin music centers in the universe, you know?
Right.
And they should always, you know, if they're going to go to the Village Vanguard, that's good, but also check the Jazz on the Tube Afro-Latin music venues list, because sometimes there are things happening that you just can't believe how great they are. They may not get the promotion, though, that some other events would get, so it's sort of up to you as the listener to do your research. But I guarantee, I went to an event this summer. Hostos put it together. It was the Bomba en Plena conference.
Oh yeah, the Bomba Plenazo. That's been happening for years.
Oh my God. And then I went to the Casa de Chema.
Right.
That's got to be one of the top five musical experiences of my entire life, hanging out with those people and listening to them play. They started at noon. It was supposed to go till 5. At 6, they were still rocking. I was exhausted. I had to go home. There was no sense that it was going to ever end. It was the best music. It was the best feeling. And if I hadn't been tracking all these different places, all these different events in the Bronx, I would have missed it.
Right. Well, it's funny you say the La Casa de Chema, which I was last night. I was saw Desiree, Chema's daughter. Like me and Elena were at a conference about how to do community activism, and obviously doing activism through music is one of the things that the Casa de Chema is famous for. Now, for those of you who don't know who we're talking about, Chema was a Puerto Rican man who lived in the Melrose area, where I'm from in the South Bronx, the Fort Apache area, and this was during the time like all this planned shrinkage was going on and the drugs and everything else and the burning of the Bronx. Of course, there were a lot of empty lots after those buildings were burned down, those tenements. So he sees this empty lot and he starts cleaning it out and he builds this little what we call casita, which are like these little frame houses made out of wood that are very easy to construct if you know anything about woodworking and architecture, basic architecture. And these were the types of houses that you would see in Puerto Rico in the countryside, in the mountain countryside. So Chema, with some forensics, starts cleaning out this lot and he builds this house, this casita. The city, some developers came in and you can't use this property because there's going to be a housing built here or whatever. Something's going to be built here. So the city wisely moved him to another lot. And where is the lot that you went to? I think it's on 156th Street. And I forgot the street corner, but it's 156th. So anyway, he's been there for years, and he passed away, but his family continues this tradition of the casita. Now, there are many other casitas in the South Bronx area, some in Manhattan, the Lower East Side, but they all, ground zero is La Casa de Chema, the House of Chema. Oh,
yeah,
casita that he built. What was
amazing is it was such a community feeling. And, you know, basically people brought their drums. Everybody was good. People would come and go. I saw one beautiful thing. One guy had his baby who was, I'd say one. I don't even think this baby was a toddler yet. And he had built a little square frame drum. You know how people wear their babies in front of them now these days?
Right, facing
out. So he was wearing his baby that way. And then he was holding this little drum in front of his baby's hands. And I thought, man, that just sums it all up. That's the whole story, you know?
It's basically Africa and the New World. You know, that's the so-called New World. And the thing is, I've been there to Chema's, you know, frequently, except it's, like you said, it's just a familiar, right? When you walked in, you were welcomed. Nobody messed with you. You know, nobody said, hey, who the hell are you? You know, like, it was like basically embraced. You were embraced. And the music that's played there is bomba, which is this really Afro-Congolese-based tradition in Puerto Rico. Our drums are different than conga drums. They're barrels, what we call barriles de bomba. They were originally made from old rum barrels, you know, unloaded by blacks, you know, in the coastal regions of Puerto Rico, and goat skin is put on them, and we play. And the other type of rhythm music that you'll hear at La Casa de Chema is plena, which are these round frame drums. They look like tambourines, but they have no jingles, and they're called panderetas, and we play plena, which is like our newspaper. And because the drums are portable, you can walk around and you would go from village to village in what we call a parranda during Christmas time and do what we call asaltos, musical assaults, where you would knock on somebody's door at 1 a.m, 2 a.m, and all of a sudden they open the door and you hear the music, you know. So we just recently did one in that area where we visited all these casitas, you know, in the neighborhood that Chema's original casita is. So it's a great tradition, Puerto Rican tradition, different than Afro-Cuban music, these rhythms, which is another sad thing about that article that kind of brought us together talking in the Village Voice, I mean, sorry, in the what was it, in the New York Times.
In the Times, yeah, the Times.
Yeah, they just mentioned Cuban artists, and that just reinforces the falsehood that it's only Cubans that are, that it's only our Cuban brothers and sisters that are making any types of inroads and our importance in terms of this Latin jazz tradition continuum. I mean, there are many, many artists doing things, particularly in New York City, that are not Cuban. Puerto Rican, obviously. There's Venezuelans, Colombians. There's a big Colombian community here doing things, fusing Colombian rhythms with jazz here in New York City, led by people like Pablo Mayor. And they're teaching that music, too. Whatever country in Latin America that exists, I mean, there's 22 of them, that music is here in New York City. You can find it. And there are young people fervently studying jazz in these countries that are coming to New York and other parts of the United States that are fusing their folklore with jazz. And the other great stream of Latin jazz is Brazilian jazz, Brazilian music. Mm-hmm. So there's, forget it, in New York City, there's tons of great musicians doing that. And I was just kind of saddened by that myopia of the article, you know. So, you know, I mean, like I said before, whenever you read something, whenever you see something, just remember, oh, man, this is just the tip of the iceberg. I got to keep exploring, and hopefully, you'll be curious enough to do that. So, I can just tell you right now that the Manhattan School of Music and at the New School where I teach, those are two venues you can go to regularly hear this music in a big band context, because I'm teaching those orchestras there, and we do regular concerts.
Okay.
And there's tons of other places. I'm sure when I look at that list, I'll add some more and everything. And, you know, it's great we're having this conversation. You know? So, you know, hats off to you. Kudos to you. Because most people would, like, say, oh, okay, you know, whatever, you know. And you actually took the time out to reach out to me and answer me back. And we're having this great conversation, you know. So.
Well, I've learned so much. And, hey, for people that want to keep up with you, what's a good way for people to put you on their radar so they can follow what you're doing?
Oh, you can go to BobbySanabria.com. Very simple. BobbySanabria.com. And you can go, I'm on Twitter at BobbySanabria. I'm on Instagram, which is my Instagram moniker is New Jack Rican, which is spelled N-U as in Utah, J-A. C-K-R-I-C-A-N. And I'm on Facebook. My Facebook page is open to everybody, Bobby Sanabria. And anybody that wants to get in touch with me can do so. Send me a private message through Facebook.
Great. Yeah. Great. Well,
but,
Bobby,
also,
thank you.
Yeah, also, you know, the other thing is, too, that, you know, check out the recordings that I've done. All the big band recordings that I've done have been nominated for Grammys. So this state-of-the-art examples. I'm very proud of them. It's really ironic because never in my wildest dream did I think I would lead my own big band. But back in 1999, I started it, and our first recording was nominated for a Grammy in 2000. Our subsequent recordings have been, and then two of the recordings I've done, Manhattan School of Music Big Band, have been nominated for Grammys. So check them all out. I mean, you can get them at Amazon.com. And the recordings with the Manhattan School of Music Band, if you purchase those, the money goes to a scholarship fund.
Okay.
And there's also a new book that I have out in conjunction with Trevor Salem, great percussionist and drummer from Canada. Kind of helped edit it and advise him with it. So it's called The Conga and Bongo in Jazz, How to Play Those Instruments in a Jazz Context.
Wow.
So that's published by Mel Bay. And the money for that goes to a scholarship fund in Candido's name.
No kidding.
The great NEA jazz master, the father of modern conga drumming, who's 95 years old and is still performing amazingly, you know.
I saw him at Hostos last spring, and you know, he is 95, and he needed a little help getting to his place, his seat. But
right.
I brought a friend who's kind of new to all this music, and when his palm hit that skin the first time, she said it was like he took control of the whole auditorium with that one strike. So this man has a lot of power. This man has a lot of power, and he is 95. So if you get a chance to see him, do not miss it.
Right.
I also want to say, do not miss February 24th at the Manhattan School of Music. You know, we've had a good chance to get to know Bobby a little bit, and I think you get a sense of the depth there. So he's bringing his students to perform West Side Story, but using the Latin, the Afro-Latin rhythms. So this is an amazing event, and unbelievably, it's free. So that's February 24th. That's New York City. If you're in the city, just forget whatever else you were planning that night. Just go. And,
exactly.
And even if you're in Philly or something or Boston, get a room, you know, and have a weekend in New York and check this out. This 60th anniversary of the West Side Story with these amazing arrangements. It's a good thing for us to do.
Yeah, and you can,
well, Bobby,
you can see the orchestra on YouTube. Just look up Manhattan School of Music Afro-Cuban Jazz Orchestra, MSM. You'll see videos. I'm really proud of these students. And the orchestra is like, we had to expand the orchestra slightly because of all the percussion we're using, vibes, timpani, and all that stuff. So it's basically like a 24-piece jazz orchestra performing this music. So you'll never hear West Side Story perform like this. It's really amazing. And I mean, I'm very proud of the students. And also the arrangers. The secret of any big band are the arrangers. And the arrangers have been ex-students of mine who have graduated from the school and one current student and under my supervision. And it's been a labor of love. But, you know, like I said, you'll never hear West Side Story done like this ever again. So please come. And it'll be recorded. Hopefully it'll be released as another recording of these great young talent. And also, as Kenneth said, you know, support the music. The best way to support it is obviously by going to see the music and hear the music live, but also share it with young people. Don't keep it to yourself. Share it with young people. Just everybody always, one of the detractions of jazz, people tell me is, well, you know, it's music for adults. And I go, well, when did you fall in love with jazz? Oh, well, you know, I saw something on TV when I was 10 years old. That's when I get the message. Yeah, you're 10 years old. What are you talking about? It's music for adults. Yeah?
Right.
So that's like ridiculous. I mean, and what better way to get young people into jazz than through Latin jazz, which with all these exciting rhythms that just make you want to move and groove. So this is a great way for you to opportunity for young people. So bring young people to the concert as well.
Excellent. Thank you for that suggestion. It's obvious, but sometimes we got to say the obvious. But yeah, bring the kids. They're going to love it. You know, it's funny that you mentioned West Side Story. And we had about 10 records when I was a kid at home, and one of them was West Side Story. And I wore that thing out. The music is spectacular. So to hear it with Bobby's group and these arrangements, it's going to be a real treat. So Bobby Sanabria, it's fantastic to get to meet you finally and to get to know a little bit about you. I know there's so much more we didn't cover. We'll have to return to this sometime and go deeper. But thank you for the time. I really appreciate it. I know everybody listening through Jazz on the Tube appreciated it too.
Great. Thank you so much for the opportunity. It's been a privilege and an honor.
Great. And we'll see you February 24th, Friday at Manhattan School of Music.
Thank you, man. Remember, que viva el Bronx. Long live the Bronx.
Exactamente.
Take care, Ken. All right, bye.
Hey, Bobby, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome, man. I got to meet you personally, so I'm assuming you're going to be there at the concert. So,
what's that?
I'm assuming you're going to be there at the concert, you know.
Yeah, I'm going to try to bring my nephew, too.
Well, get there a little early. And maybe you could see some of the dress rehearsal or some of the rehearsal or just get there a little early. I could meet you at least beforehand, you know.
Okay.
I would get there early because it's going to get packed. So there's a restaurant, like I said, in the school, and you can, you know, hang out there and eat beforehand. So I would really get there I would say an hour and a half before the concert starts. Yeah,
great. We'll get some food and then we'll get our ticket, get some food, and we'll be set.
You got it. Talk to you, man.
Right. Hey, a pleasure. Thank you.
Same here. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.